Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to find out about radishes and our health, vitamin E, and lowering your risk of Alzheimer's. Pecans, they can help your heart. New research on plants preventing cancer. A fountain of youth in your muscles. Some new muscle cell understanding of aging. Healing your mind and gut with catnip. Discovering the benefits of ashwagandha. And pure maple syrup contains medicinally beneficial compounds. So we have a lot to share on health and healing. From our environmental segment today, we have three topics. Could fracking spark a modern-day dust bowl? The water crisis. It's worse than what we even had imagined. Lake Mead, the largest U.S. reservoir, faces federal water emergency force rationing. What does that mean to Las Vegas? Bad to the bone. Billions of mysterious creatures dead along the West Coast. I just discussed this yesterday. New information on this. It's not millions, it's billions upon billions of creatures. These starfish and also jellyfish are washing up in amounts never before seen in history. Plus today, a series of commentaries from our public health towards a ban on psychiatrically diagnosed children and the drugging of those children by Peter Briggan. Also, The Hidden Tears of Punjab by Andrea Vilcek from Weekend Edition. From Glenn Greenwald from The Intercept, Israel's horrific brutality and more criminality in Gaza. Also today, I want to share with you a larger, deeper historical context to what we're seeing in Baltimore and other places. The news media is very specific in what it wants to cover. It does not pull back far enough to look at what allowed this to occur. So we're going to take a trip back in time today. We're going to look at Emmett Till. We're also going to look at other cultures who have done the same and then wonder why today they have social challenges. We'll look at India and a commentary about how the British treated the Indians in the 18th century. We'll also look at the Aboriginal tribes of Australia. So we have a lot to share. Also, our guest in the second part of our program from British Columbia is Dr. Jills Slade. And we're going to take a look at population migration trends in North America in the future due to climate change. Now, if you could imagine what it's like to have an American exodus, where people no longer can simply survive in certain parts of the United States, both in the northern latitudes and the southern. We're going to discuss that today. You'll find that interesting. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. We always begin with health and healing. And one of the foods that doesn't get much attention, but it should, is a radish. Now, radishes are available year-round. They're easy to grow. And radishes, known as daikons, D-A-I-K-E-N-S, in some parts of the world, they offer a lot of nutritional benefits. They're also part of the cruciferous family, and as we know, we should be having cruciferous every single day, 7 days a week. Helps prevent cancer, builds up our immune system. But radishes are very strong in vitamin C and calcium. They're great for your kidneys, fighting cancer, and it's rich in folic acid and anthocyanins. Now, these are nutrients that make it very effective cancer-fighting food. It's said that radish is effective in fighting oral cancer, colon cancer, and intestinal cancer, kidney and stomach cancers. So put some radishes each day into your salads. Even juice a radish. They're terrific for you. And by the way, it's very good at treating jaundice. It's able to help the destruction of red blood cells and to increase the supply of oxygen to the blood. So it's a diuretic. If you're overweight, radishes juiced, maybe three or four radishes diluted in celery juice, It's a great way to help you with urinary tract infections. In fact, it's one of the best things for all form of bladder infections. It's a great kidney cleanser as well. Then we have vitamin E. Now, vitamin E in its natural form is terrific for you. But there's some new research showing that it actually impacts ALS, which is a fatal neurological condition. It's amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And it's also called Lou Gehrig's disease because a great Yankee baseball player had it. It's invariably fatal, in which the nerve cells that control movement progressively degenerate, leading to paralysis and death from respiratory failure. A lot of Americans get it every year. But some research has suggested vitamin E could make a difference in lowering your risk of getting it. Now, that's very important. I'm suggesting the natural vitamin E, and this research was done at Harvard University, and it combined the results of the five large U.S. studies involving a million adults. So it's a major study. And so it was published in the American Journal of Epidemiology. So here's what is the outcome. Take your vitamin E. I'm suggesting 400 units in the morning, 400 units before you go to bed at night from natural tocopherols, mixed tocopherols, and also tocotrienols. One nut that rarely gets any attention is pecans. And according to the Journal of Nutrition, as reported in Science Daily, pecans have antioxidants that could contribute to having a healthier heart and preventing disease overall. Now, pecans contain different forms of antioxidant vitamin E, known as tocopherols, plus numerous phenolic substances, which are antioxidants. Now, what this means is they grab bad inflammatory-causing free radicals and neutralize them. So the more of these phenolic compounds you have, the more antioxidants you have, the less damage to your cells. So taking vitamin C throughout the day, I suggest 6 to 7 to 8 times, having some good quality oils, and then having quality nuts, a different nut each day, pecans one day, almonds, pistachios, filberts, walnuts, cashews, pine nuts, and that can substantially impact your cholesterol and turn off inflammation in your arteries and lower your risk of cardiovascular disease. Quote from the study from the professor at the School of Public Health Department of Nutrition that conducted this. Here's what it says. Quote, our tests show that eating pecans increases the amount of healthy antioxidants in the body. This protective effect is important in helping to prevent the development of various diseases such as cancer and heart disease. So that's good. So make sure you're getting some pecans. How much? Well, normally a handful. This was done at Loma Linda University. Also, some really good information. This is from the University of Minnesota. And they found that a plant-based food, that's your vegan diet, could be used as an effective intervention therapy for cancer prevention and the development of other high-risk diseases. So why? The phytochemicals. And that's crucial. This was published in Nature Reviews in Cancer. So the more vegetables you have, the more plant-based nutrients you consume, your greens, your reds, your purples, your yellows, the healthier you're going to be, the longer your lifespan. And talking about lengthening the lifespan, there's a really good study from Tel Aviv University, and it was reported in Science Daily. And here's what it says, and this was published in PLOS ONE. Quote, working out can help you shed pounds, but that's just the beginning. New research from Tel Aviv University has found that endurance exercises like a Central Park jog or a spinning class can make you look younger. The key exercise unlocks the stem cells of our muscles. Professor Benyahu and her team at Tel Aviv University's Sackler School of Medicine say their findings explain for the first time why older people who have exercised throughout their lives age more gracefully. They've discovered how endurance exercise increases the number of muscle stem cells and enhances their ability to rejuvenate old muscles. The researchers hope their findings can lead to a new drug to help the elderly and immobilize to help the body heal. Well, here's my thought. Why look for a drug? We have functional foods. We have grapes, grape juice, grape concentrate, grape powders that have resveratrol and proanthocyanidins, grape skin and grape seed extract. Those are your number one anti-aging nutrients. The more you take, the younger you are, the more protected you are. We have L-carnosine, the single most important nutrient for protecting the telomeres at the end of your chromosomes. So we can take 1,000, 2,000 milligrams of that a day. Then we exercise 5 to 6 days a week aerobically for an hour. You put all that together, and you don't need a drug. Your lifestyle's the drug. This is an interesting study about catnip. Now, most people know that catnip is famous for being given to cats, and it also benefits humans as well. Now, catnip, or nepeta, Cataria, is part of the mint family. And many of the mint family herbs, including catnip, contain volatile oils. Well, the takeaway message is these volatile oils, like thymol, make the mint family powerful antibacterials and antiseptics. And catnip is called the baby mint because it has these effects, but is still gentle. So catnip is used for colds and flu, and it is a diaphoretic, and it's very good. It's a nervine. It calms you down, so people who are very stressed, who are anxious, could have a cup of catnip tea. And it is very calming also for our cats. So it also helps with our gut, our GI tract, calms it down, relieves flatulence, colic, and so diarrhea. So that's all important. And finally, two things. First is ashwagandha. Ash, A-S-H, wag, W-A-G, ananda, A-N-D-H-A. Now, this is an herb that's grown in North America, but mainly in India. It's called the Indian winter cherry. And it's made from the brown roots of the shrub. And it's really powerful. They use it for so many different things, both in Africa and in India, and as did the Native Americans. Infections, it helps with that. It also helps you build up your immune system. It's an anti-inflammatory, it's an antioxidant, it's anti-stress. And it can calm you down, so it's a calmative. It helps induce sleep, so it's very good in that respect. And it eases restlessness. So think of the hyperactive person, adult or child. Ashwagandha makes a difference. And organic pure maple syrup. According to Science Daily and University of Rhode Island researchers, they found that there are more than 20 compounds in maple syrup that have been linked to human health. 13 of these are brand new, just researched recently, and 8 of the compounds have been found in the maple family for the first time. And this was presented at the American Chemical Society's annual meeting from the URI's University of Rhode Island's College of Pharmacy. Quote, "We are proud that our producers are generously supporting this research, and so good for them." So maple syrup, the virgin maple syrup, organic, has 20 different medicinal beneficial compounds in it. So that's good. I'm Gary Nall. That's our health and nutrition report. Now, from our environment, we have several things to talk about that are of concern. The first, as I mentioned yesterday, that we have a brand new weather pattern coming in that's going to play havoc with the West Coast, the entire West Coast, from Alaska clear down to Bayou. And what is happening is that the warmer water is getting so warm, and it's adversely affecting the cold water where a lot of the algae grow, and then the smaller fish and sea vertebrae eat that, and then the larger fish eat them. So that's not happening now. As a result, according to Energy News, quote, billions of blue jellyfish wash up on American beaches in recent weeks. About a billion jellyfish, purple sailors they're called, have washed up on West Coast beaches. They've washed up Oregon, Washington State, in the last 4 to 6 weeks. Now they're showing up in California. This is from KOMO. There's an unusual sea creature being pushed ashore, clear up through the Bering Sea. Beachcombers are finding something blue that's out of the ordinary. This is something that doesn't happen often. For almost a month now, a jellyfish-like creature called the vela has been washing up by the billions. And then there are other news reports about, quote, billions of creatures wash ashore. Piles of sea animals have been washing ashore of late. These creatures are all over right now, changing the landscape of local beaches, according to local biologists. The death totals are staggering. Quote, it's got to be billions. The Weather Channel, quote, from just last week, billions of mysterious creatures on beach, billions of vela jellyfish are washing on shore. And yet none of them are suggesting this could be from Fukushima, which is here now on the West Coast, and it could also be from global warming and the changing temperatures of the sea. So that's only going to get worse. You can expect to see hundreds of thousands of larger mammals dying, and then the whales and the dolphins. It's going to be happening all within the next 12 months. I mentioned that we're in a water crisis. It's going to get way worse than anything you could ever imagine. They're trying to put a good spin on this in California, saying, okay, so we'll cut back on our water consumption. You know, it's 25% for users. But friends, only about 4 to 7% of all the water used in California is used by people. Most of it's used by gas hydrofracking, oil production, and farming, cattle farming, almond groves, and vegetable farming. And that, they're not going to cut back because that would bankrupt the state. So where are all these new developments going to get their water for their golf courses? They're not. And those that have golf courses are going to be paying extra fees until finally, and I predict this will actually happen in the next 2 to 3 years, all of your golf courses are going to be without water. Then watch the exodus of people who no longer have their favorite hobby to go golfing or look out on a beautiful golf course that they paid hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars for. So they're trying to keep the public from freaking out, panicking, and moving to a more sustainable environment. The wise person in California, move. All right? Your state is not sustainable. But for the next 2 to 5 years, if you've got enough money, you'll be able to still maintain a lifestyle that will hardly be imperceptible from what it is today. For everyone else, too bad. But I'm also suggesting that Las Vegas could be seeing the beginning of a protracted emergency. Why? Where does Las Vegas get all of its water? Lake Mead. Why is that important? Because Lake Mead's the largest U.S. reservoir. Quote from Wolf Richter. Lake Mead, on your left when you drive from Las Vegas across the Hoover Dam, is the largest reservoir in the country when at capacity. It's fed by the Colorado River, which provides water for agriculture, industry, and 40 million people in Nevada, Arizona, California, Mexico, including Los Angeles, San Diego, Phoenix, and Las Vegas. Now, after 15 years of drought, the lake, a mud puddle surrounded by huge chalky bathtub rings, is threatening to run dry. is considered operationally full when the water level is at 1,229 feet elevation above sea level. On May 2nd, the water level was down to 1,078 feet above sea level, the lowest since it was filled in May of 1937. It's down 15 feet from this day a year ago, and over the last 36 months, it's gone down 44.8 feet. It's down 150 feet from capacity. If the water level is below 1,075 feet, 4 feet below today's level, by January, it will trigger a federal water emergency and water rationing. Okay, so when they say, well, it's 1,078 feet above sea level, that does not mean that it's 1,078 foot deep. It means that it's elevated, just like Denver is 5,000 feet. It's Mile High City. So what you have is you only have 5 more feet of water that you lose before you trigger an emergency and water rationing. You're going to lose that if there's no major runoff, and there's not, by probably me June, July. So expect a lot of water rationing in Las Vegas. And also they're rushing to finish an $800 million tunnel being built by the Southern Nevada Water Authority to create a new drain to get the last drop out of there. But that means that there's not going to be any water in the near future. Within 2 years, you've got 40 million people going to have to figure out another way of getting their water, because it isn't going to be there for them. Not the way it has been. So I predict Las Vegas, enjoy the time you have. You're on death watch. Wish it weren't so, but it is. Also, finally, from our environmental segment, could fracking spark a modern-day dust bowl? This is from Echo Watch. Quote, oil wells and natural gas may have made individual Americans rich, but they have impoverished the Great Plains of North America. According to newest research, fossil fuel prospectors have sunk 50,000 new wells a year since 2000 in 3 Canadian provinces and 11 U.S. states, and have damaged the foundation of all economic growth and net primary production, otherwise known as biomass or vegetation. A professor of rangeland ecology at the University of Montana's College of Forestry and Conservation and colleagues write in the journal Science that they combined years of high-resolution satellite data with information from industry and public records to track the impact of oil drilling on natural and crop growth. They conclude that the vegetation lost or removed by the expansion of oil and gas business in the last 12 years adds up to 10 million tons of dry vegetation. That's a huge amount of fodder that's lost. And put that in equivalent, that would be equivalent to 120 million bushels of wheat from that cropland. And that's 13% of the entire amount of wheat that we export. So what we're doing is we're destroying quality land, quality soil, quality water for this. And we're going to get hit with a giant dust bowl over at least 8 states. You're looking at North Dakota and South Dakota, Utah, Wyoming, Colorado. You're going to see New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and those are the states that are going to be just dust bowls. And we're not talking about in the far future. We're talking about coming up now. I want to just commend Dr. Peter Bregan for his article, Towards a Ban on Psychiatrically Diagnosing and Drugging Children, from Preventive Psychiatry, number 458. I read it this morning. Here's what he says in brief. Instead of hope and enthusiasm for their futures, too many children now grow up believing they are inherently defective and controlled by bad genes and biochemical imbalances. They are shackled by the idea they have ADHD and then subdued by the drugs that inevitably go along with the diagnosis. Unless something intervenes, many of them will go on to pass their days on earth in a drug-impaired, demoralized state. He is right, and I'm glad that he is speaking out on it, and we commend him and everyone else. He wrote an article in the Journal of Children and Society, and he presents scientific information as well as ethical insights on the harm done to children by stimulants and antipsychotic drugs, Seroquel, Risperdal, Invega, Zyprexa, Safris. And he cites many scientific studies, and the antipsychotic drugs are often given to children when their behavior or mental state deteriorates as a result of being given stimulants. And the drugging of children in America and increasingly throughout the world is a tragedy, and I believe that we should face it and make it a major worldwide issue. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come back and take on some important issues. Let me mention also, for those of you who can't always get to your land-based station that you listen to over the radio or over the internet, you can always listen by calling a phone number. Let me give you the phone number now. Always have this because you never know when you're going to be out and you could use it. 712-432-7231. 712-432-7231. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. I believe that we cannot understand the full impact of any given individual or group upon a society where there has been so much historical injustice. To leave that out of the equation and merely look now whether or not a person goes to a public school or private school, whether or not they have one parent or two parents, begs the historical issue. It is the progenitor. Not just in the United States, but throughout the world. I'm going to give you three examples right now. First, we're going to give you the example of the British, because what the British have not done, from the Queen on down, is to publicly acknowledge the enormous harm that little tiny nation has caused upon the world. It should hold itself in shame and at least posture something in the way of contriteness, but it does not. Instead, it goes along with every imperialistic motive and direction that we have given it. It has participated in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, you name it, they're always there. And yet they seem to have learned nothing from their own sordid and completely evil history. There's a lane. It's a according to Andrea Vilcek, it's a narrow passage. It's a garden inside of an old city in Amritsar, in the state of Punjab in India. And what it is, it's a monument now. I'll bet not one in a million Americans ever heard of it. But it's one of the testaments to madness and crimes committed by the British Empire during its colonial reign over subcontinent. This is where, on April 13th, 1919, thousands of people gathered demanding release of two of their detained leaders, two physicians. It was right before the day of the main Sikh festival and the pilgrimage to that city. And the British general, he's a brigadier general, Reginald Dyer, brought 50 of the riflemen to a bank around them and ordered them to shoot at the crowd. There's an Indian historian, Bipan Chandra, who wrote in his iconic work, India's Struggle for Independence, which I recommend to everyone in this audience, quote, on the orders of Brigadier General Reginald Dyer, the army fired on the crowd for 10 minutes, directing their bullets largely towards the few open gates through which people were trying to run out. The figures released by the British government were 370 dead and 1,200 wounded, others put over 1,000 dead. While reading through the draft, you can't help but understand how this impacts people today. At the investigation into the massacre, General Dyer, said his only regret was that he had not killed more people. He also used armored cars to block the entrances, and machine guns were also used on the crowd. These were unarmed people, by the way. They came in prayer and nonviolence. And after the British made people in the street crawl on the stomachs when they pass a British officer, terrible, terrible things, and what the British did in Kenya in the 1950s is even worse than what many people could imagine a human being could do to another people. But this is what they did. And in fact, you could go there now and the bullet holes are still clearly there. So you can see what this carnage was. It's a museum now. It contains historical documents and statements of defiance and spite from the officials of the British Raj, and who, as well as declarations of several maverick Indian figures, one of the greatest writers of India, who threw his knighthood back in the faces of the British oppressors after he learned of the massacre. Now, there are old black and white photos of Punjabi people tied to poles, their buttocks exposed, being beaten by shorts wearing British soldiers who were apparently enjoying their heinous acts. There's also a statement by General Dyer himself in a chilling, arrogant, unapologetic statement. This sounds like Schwarzkopf. It sounds like Colin Powell. It sounds like everyone in power anywhere, in our Senate, our House, the White House, the presidents, even in the media. Bill O'Reilly couldn't have said this better. Quote, "I fired and continued to fire until the crowd dispersed, and I consider this is the least amount of firing which would produce the necessary moral and widespread effect it was my duty to produce if I was to justify my actions. If more troops had been at hand, the casualties would have been greater in proportion. It was no longer a question merely of dispersing the crowd, but one of producing a sufficient moral effect from a military point of view, not only on those who were present, but more especially throughout Punjab. There could be no question of undue severity." End quote. Now think of drones. Think of a million dead people in Iraq. Think of night raids. Think of raping in prisons and people's homes by American soldiers. Nowhere else could we expect this, and yet this happened. This is real. And so when we look at how people feel today in different parts of the world by our being there, why don't we ask this? How do you think the average American would feel, the average person in Congress, the average newspaper editor, the average sports columnist, the average school teacher, if suddenly we had hundreds of thousands of foreign troops land on our soil, break into our homes, take over our government, and start summarily arresting, disappearing, torturing, and killing American civilians? And yet we wonder why they don't like us, why they committed the 9/11 attacks. I'm trying to give you a historical perspective. All the people in France, England, the United States, Canada, who've engaged in Belgium, who've engaged in colonialism, imperialism, well, this is called blowback. In fact, who was it? Lloyd George, who was British Prime Minister between 1916 and 1922, and was never someone to back off from respecting empire. He completely supported this subversion of subcontinent Africa, and that became the new norm. Commanders in charge of slaughtering thousands of people in the colonies were promoted, not demoted, and their statues have been decorating countless squares and government buildings. But nobody ever stops and asks, what exactly did this soldier do to deserve this statue? The British Empire has considered itself above the law. All rights to punish locals were reserved, but British citizens were almost never punished for their horrendous crimes committed in foreign lands. Nor do we punish anyone from the CIA, the National Security Agency, Homeland Security, the Air Force, Army, and Special Ops. We public punish no one, unless we have no choice because they've been caught and they can embarrass people. But otherwise, all crimes go unpunished. So today's Western Empire is clearly following its predecessors, so nothing has changed, just technology. That's all it is. So think about the concentration camps in Africa, about the stations where slaves who were first hunted down like animals were shackled and beaten, and then put on boats and forced to undergo voyages to the so-called New World, voyages that most of them never managed to survive. Think about the murder, the torture, the flogging, the raping women and men, destruction of entire countries, tribes and families. It is all connected. Colonialism, present-day riots in Baltimore, hard ruins of Africa. So that is what we have become. Now, I want you to hear this segment about Emmett Till and how so little has changed from then until now.
I know the one thing we did right,
hey!
Was the day we started to fight. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
On August 21st, 1955, two teenagers from Chicago boarded a train and traveled south to visit family in Mississippi.
We was going down there to pick some cotton, because I'd never picked any cotton before, and I was looking forward to do that, because I had told my mother that I could pick 200 pounds, and she told me I could, you know. So we was going down there to look for a good time, you know.
For more than a year, racial tensions in the South had been higher than usual. Since the Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus Board of Education that segregated schools were unconstitutional. The decision touched a raw nerve in the White South, and many organized to preserve white supremacy. For years, groups like the Ku Klux Klan practiced terrorism. Despite national black protests, public murders of blacks were common, and the mobs who committed them went unpunished. In the previous 70 years, there had been more than 500 documented lynchings in Mississippi alone. Coming from Chicago, Curtis Jones and his cousin Emmett Till had little sense of the world they were entering when they arrived in Money, Mississippi.
Emmett Till was, at the time, he was 14 years old. He had just graduated out of grammar school. He had some picture of some white kids that he had graduated from. That was, you know, female and male. So he told the boys down there, you know, hey, you got around this store? This must have been around about maybe 10 to 12, you know, youngsters around there, that the girls was his girlfriend, you know. So one of the local boys said, hey, there's a girl in that store there, so I bet you want to go in there and talk to her, you know. So he went in there to, you know, get some candy. So when he was leaving out the store, after buying the candy, he told us, said, bye, baby. And the next thing I knew, one of the boys came up to me and say, man, you got a crazy cousin. He just went in there and said bye to that white woman. And that's when this man, I was playing checker with this older man, I guess he must have been around about 60 or 70, he jumped straight up and say, boy, say, y'all about to get out of here, say, that lady come out of that store and blow y'all brains out.
This is Mose Wright. I am the uncle of Emmett Lewis Till. Sunday morning, about 2:30, someone called at the door. And I said, who is it? And he said, this is Mr. Bryant. I want to talk with you and the boy. And when I opened the door, there was a man standing with a pistol in one hand and a flashlight in the other hand. And he asked me, did I have two boys They're from Chicago. I told him I have. And he said, I want the boy that done all that talk. And they marched him to the car, and they asked someone there, was this is the right boy? And the answer was, here. And they drove toward money.
4 days later, Emmett Till's body was found in the Tallahatchie River.
The body was so badly damaged that we couldn't hardly just tell who he was, but he happened to have on a ring with his initial, and that cleared it up.
The body was shipped home, back north to Chicago, where Mamie Till Bradley insisted on an open casket funeral. So all the world can see, she said, what they did to my boy. Jet magazine showed Till's corpse, beaten, mutilated, shot through the head. An entire generation of young black people would remember the horror of that photo. Roy Bryant, husband of the woman in the store, and J.W. Milam, her brother-in-law, were arrested for the murder of Emmett Till. The trial was held in nearby Sumner, Mississippi. Black organizations like the NAACP and the black press worked especially hard to keep the case in the news, to make an example of Southern racism for the world.
I had covered the courts in many areas of this country. But the Till case was unbelievable. I mean, I just didn't get the sense of being in a courtroom. It was, first place, segregated. The black press sat at a bridge table far off from the court. And the boy's mother came down. They sat her there at the bridge table with us.
What do you intend to do here today?
To answer any questions that the attorneys might ask me to answer, to the
how
best.
How do you think you could possibly be a help to them?
I don't know. I mean, just by answering whatever questions that they ask me.
I see. Do you have any evidence bearing on this case?
I do know that this is my son.
The defense argued that the body found tied to the cotton gin fan in the river was so disfigured that it could not be identified as Emmett Till. The trial took 5 long, hot days. The prosecution's star witness was Till's uncle, Mose Wright, who testified despite threats to his life.
He was called upon to, could he see anybody in the courtroom, identify anybody in that courtroom that had come to his house that night and got the Emmett Till out. He stood up, and there was a tension in the courtroom. And he says, in his broken language, "Dar he."
Dar he, there he is.
I really didn't realize how brave my grandfather Mose Wright was, you know. But after I got older, I realized that he was a brave man. He was a mighty brave man to travel back down there, you know, among all those hostile peoples and testify and get him up in court and point his finger at a white man and accuse him of murder.
As the trial ended, a defense lawyer told the jury he was, quote, sure every last Anglo-Saxon one of you has the courage to free these men. It took the jury an hour to find the men not guilty. Months later, for a fee of $4,000, Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam told their story to reporter William Bradford Huey.
Malum was startled at the belligerent attitude or the fact that young Till didn't appear to be afraid of him. Now, he'd gone and gotten him out of bed and had him in the back of a truck, and young Till never realized the danger he was in. I'm quite sure that he never thought these two men would kill him. Or maybe he's just in such a strange environment, he just doesn't know what he's up against. And it seems, to a rational mind today, it seems impossible that they could have killed him. But J.W. Milam looked up at me and said, well, when he told me about this white girl he had, he says, my friend, that's what this war is about down here now. He says, that's what we got to fight to protect. And he says, I just looked at him and I said, boy, you ain't going to never see the sun come up again.
I believe that the whole United States is more.
So what happened was, after they were found innocent for an amount of money, they then confessed, but nothing could happen because of double jeopardy. They couldn't be tried twice. So they killed him, got away with it. So imagine what that does, and imagine the 5,000-plus hangings, lynchings, burnings, castrations that occurred mainly to black men in the South. Now jump forward and imagine 500,000 stops and searches. You're not seeing any, not a single person on Wall Street stopped and searched, no banker stopped and searched, no one going into affluent neighborhood stopping and searching, not going into private white school stopping and searching. Now imagine what happens when you're arrested, you're tasered, you're beaten, you're threatened, drugs are planted on you, and you know that the system is against you. Until such time that this also is put into the equation, how in the world can anyone make any reasonable and responsible statements about the problems we're seeing today unless they understand the Emmett Tills and the countless number of people who are affected by institutional racism, which is as bad today as it's ever been in American history, because those people who know better and do not do better, those who cannot be inconvenienced in time or place to stand up for injustice. And going back to the English, who are, in my opinion, one of the most irresponsible, reprehensibly vile and evil groups of people in the history of the world, let me just give you another example of why people have been angry at the English. In Uganda, it was well known of how the British colonizers used to humiliate local people and break their pride. In the villages, they would hunt down the tallest and the strongest man, and they would shackle him and beat him, and then the British officers would rape them, sodomize them in public, so there would be no doubts of who was in charge. In the Middle East, people still remember those savage chemical bombings of the locals, the extermination of entire tribes. Winston Churchill, a completely demonic human being, made it clear on several occasions, quote, I do not understand the squeamishness about the use of gas. He said this at the House of Commons during an address in autumn of 1937, quote, I'm strongly in favor of using poisonous gas against uncivilized tribes. He and Dick Cheney and everyone else in our military-industrial complex share similar feelings. In Malaya, as the Japanese were approaching, British soldiers were chaining locals to the cannons, forcing them to fight or die. The Brits triggered countless famines all over India, killing tens of millions. The largest genocides in history were done by the British. To them, Indian people were not humans. When Churchill was begged to send food to Bengal that was ravished by famine in 1943, he replied, and it's a matter of his official biography, quote, well, it's their own fault for, quote, breeding like rabbits, and that the plague was merrily culling the population. 3 million of them died. Didn't have to. Wherever the British Empire or any other European empire grabbed control of the territory in Africa, the Caribbean, Middle East, Asia, the subcontinent, Oceania, horror and brutality reigned. America now is the leader in dehumanizing criminal activity worldwide. I'm Gary Nall. Tomorrow we'll take a look at other areas We're also going to take a look at Australia. Australia today is also barbaric, primordial, run by a group of fascists. I've been asked to lecture. I won't go to Australia. I won't dignify the energy to go there unless it would be to speak on behalf of the Aboriginal people. I will not go there and talk with a bunch of racists. Have no interest in that. Let's go now to British Columbia. We're standing by as Dr. Jills Slade, Canadian journalist, environmental activist, social critic, and a self-described recovering academic. Thank goodness for that. He holds a doctorate in cultural history from the University of Southern California. He's taught in universities around the world. His book, Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America, describes a corporate incentive to manufacture technology designed to break quickly in order to increase consumerism. He also won the International Publishers Gold Medal for Best Environmental Book in 2007 and was the basis of the documentary film The Lightbulb Conspiracy. His most recent publication is American Exodus, Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Gary.
The decline in a population's quality of life for social and economic reasons has been a contributing factor for families and individuals to migrate to other areas. But we don't think about that in Canada and the United States. We think about that in Africa, other countries. And yet, it is entirely possible to conceive that through natural catastrophes, earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamis, that force people into refugee status, or tremendous heat, or drought, or flooding, that it could also be happening in the North American continent. Could you describe your research on this and the possibility that we could be seeing movements between Canada, the United States, and Mexico?
Yeah, I guess I got interested in this because I have three sons. And I wanted to try and figure out what their lives were going to be like under climate change, the regime of climate change. And so it seemed very strange to me that climate change was something that was always sort of happening elsewhere. You know, it was happening in Darfur, it was happening in the Mediterranean, you know, but it just wasn't happening in North America. It was like we had this kind of ideological fence around ourselves. And so I started looking at, you know, the history of extreme weather events in North America, and of course the Dust Bowl popped up, you know, when 2.5 million people left the Midwest for California and Oregon and Chicago, and it occurred to me that that was a climate change event. And then I started to notice that there were, you know, those dust storms were happening again, and they were even more severe than they were in the 30s. And then there seemed to be, when I lived in Los Angeles, when I was doing my degree at University of Southern California, around 1982, there was just this influx of Mexicans to the city and to California. And at first, you know, you didn't really notice it. But then as the decade progressed, there were Mexicans, Spanish-speaking people, in every small town throughout the United States, and this has been going on now since pretty much 82. And it was explained in terms of something that the Mexicans call la crisis, which is a kind of double-barreled thing. It was an economic collapse after the oil sort of market sort of failed in Mexico. But because the oil market failed in Mexico, people started farming in any available land and really sort of collapsed the environment. And then in the 90s, northern Mexico started to heat up. The drought that is now visiting California really began in the tropics in Mexico in the 90s. And so the tropics started moving out of the tropic zone and into, northern Mexico, southern United States, southwestern United States. And there's been, a drought and a heat wave going on there for since, I guess, the turn of the millennia. And what has happened is that because of this double-barreled sort of crisis, economic and environmental, about a quarter of the population of Mexico has moved to the United States and now sleeps, eats, works, and plays and has children in the United States, so they've become the largest minority in the United States. And this has changed. I had an amazing impact on, you know, sort of the political realities of the United States. And so I started to look around and see what other things were driving people to move, both internally in the United States and from. I know a lot of Americans don't really think that Canada is a country, so you know it's just a place to go for a vacation. But a hurricane event like Katrina drove 500,000 people out of New Orleans, and only 200,000 returned. The superstorm Sandy didn't drive people out of New York, but it cost $80 billion to begin the sort of infrastructure repairs. And if that kind of thing starts happening, that's supposedly a once-in-a-century storm, but with the sea level temperatures heating up to above 30 degrees regularly now, it will happen, you know, maybe three times in a decade, and each time it will cost in excess of $80 billion. So sooner or later, people are going to decide not to live there, not to have their businesses there. And there are a lot of factors like this, the declining habitability of the Midwest, the destruction of crops in both California and the Midwest, you know, the wheat basket and the vegetable basket in Central California. And so sooner or later, people are going to begin to think that they should move to cooler climes and higher ground. And when they do that, they'll realize that certain parts of Canada are going to be fairly well off for a much longer period of time. And I think that's when we'll begin to see this movement. And I think it's been foreseen by, you know, NSA and CIA studies that this is kind of the mid-case scenario. And I don't think it's unrealistic at all. And I think we'll be seeing this within the next 20 years.
I think it'll be before 20 years. I've just been all over the southwest of the United States, every place you could imagine filming. And we're seeing wildfires, sea level rise around the coastlines, extreme storms, extended drought, particularly in the southwest and the Midwest. They're turning into dust bowls and sandstorms, diminishing water supplies. All of these are unanimously predicted to increase by climatologists. So with one out of eight and or nine people on the planet being homeless in the near future, I believe that those people, about 40 million in that area of the United States, will be seeking more sustainable environments, and going north towards Canada, for most of them, would be the most logical place to be. And I just don't believe that most Americans are going to wait until it's just uninhabitable to live in a place. I believe that they'll be making more reasoned choices after one or more, two more years of this. Final thoughts, please.
Here in Vancouver right now, there's a boom on for buying houses. Americans from Washington and Oregon are, because our dollar is so low, it's gone down 20 cents, because we're really a petro state, so our economy is tied to the price of oil. And because the dollar is so cheap, Americans are now buying up houses which had previously been very expensive here in Vancouver. And I think this is, you know, the beginning of this shift. I know several people who've moved here, from California, and think that long before, you know, Jerry Brown sort of issued his water rationing warnings a few weeks ago, and there are, in places like Las Vegas, places in the Southwest that were known as, you know, prime retirement spots that, people just poured into from the Northwest because houses were cheap and the weather was nice. But there's no longer any water for these masses of people to use. And so they've really got to move.
And they will.
Absolutely.
Especially as Lake Mead has got 5 feet to go, and it automatically triggers a national, federal water emergency rationing system. And could you imagine Las Vegas rationing water? Don't think it's going to happen. I think you're going to see some people stop going there, and then you're going to see people not no longer living there. I believe that we're going to start seeing the evacuations in the next 3 years. But it takes Americans about three major catastrophes before we finally get it. I think we'll get it. And hopefully people will understand the best places to go, and you have done a good job with climate change and coming flight for survival, the American exodus, and so at least we'll know the best places to go. Thanks a lot. Appreciate you being on.
Oh.
And from Canada, Dr. Jules Slade. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to you, Therese. Hi, you, Therese.
Hi, Gary. Today is El Cinco de Mayo, and a history lesson on why it is a very significant day.
Good. We look forward to it right now.